and welcome to Skeptically Curious. I'm your host, Ryan Rutherford. This is a podcast where I endeavor to know more and think better by talking to knowledgeable guests about fascinating topics. So please join me on this journey of exploration and edification. To many, the thought of writing likely conjures at least some of the following associations: furiously taking down notes in a lecture hall, penning an essay, composing a poem, bashing out a blog post, and/or dashing off a tweet. But what if writing could provide a means to analytically probe the innermost mental recesses for deeper reflective engagement with all aspects of our lives? Beyond even this, what if writing could serve as a powerful therapeutic tool in helping us work through trauma? And this is exactly what Dr. Jillie Bolton has spent much of her professional life over the last number of decades exploring. She is one of the pioneers in reflective writing, and incidentally, her book on the subject, Reflective Practice, has recently been updated for a sixth edition. Dr. Bolton studied social anthropology at Cambridge University, and then taught creative writing at residential colleges, and has worked with a range of professionals, including doctors and policemen, and has even worked, most tragically, with people facing the end of their lives, including, perhaps most sadly of all, children. Reflective writing emerges from an older tradition known as reflective practice, which was pioneered by such leading figures as the philosopher and educational theorist John Dewey, which we discussed in the interview. Beyond writing's ability to deepen our reflective engagement with all aspects of our life, writing can also serve as a means of therapy to help us deal with the most traumatic of events. This is known as therapeutic writing, which we also explored. I asked Jillie Bolton about her background, which is inextricably bound up with reflective writing, and we also delved into some of the practical ways that anyone can go about beginning a reflective writing practice, which can last for as little as 6 minutes a day. I asked her whether absolutely everyone can benefit from reflective writing, a question which is self-evident, but she has, of course, met with resistance among some people over her career. We spoke at some length about the value of maintaining a daily journaling practice, which I have done for many years now. In addition, I asked Dr. Bolton about Through the Mirror writing, an image which is derived from one of her favorite books, Alice in Wonderland. And I think if nothing else, although there is plenty of other aspects of value in this interview, you will probably leave with a newfound appreciation of Lewis Carroll's iconic 19th century children's book, which, as Dr. Bolton explained, is richly layered and textured. I asked her to define therapeutic writing, and then also asked if there is any danger, perhaps, in someone reliving or being re-traumatized through this practice. I asked Dr. Bolton near the end about how we can cultivate a more reflective life and society. She made a profound observation that we all too often forget, namely that we are not human doings, we are human beings. And she emphasized that we should be kind to ourselves, and also allow ourselves to ask why, and thereby open up the possibility to learn and change and become better people. Unlike in my other interviews, which have all contained great insights, I believe this episode is unique in that it provides actionable suggestions as to how we can think more deeply about our lives and improve our mental well-being. There is just about no one on earth who wouldn't benefit from engaging in this kind of reflective practice, even for, as she said, as little as 6 minutes a day. This really was an incredibly special interview for me. Dr. Bolton exudes a kindness, empathy, gentleness, compassion, and thoughtfulness we need far more of in this world. If you derive even a fraction of the enjoyment I did while listening to Dr. Bolton, this episode will be well worth it. And now, without further ado, I present Dr. Jillie Bolton. Welcome to Skeptically Curious, Dr. Jillie Bolton.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah, and I'm so very thrilled that you've decided to join me to talk about a topic I'm incredibly passionate about, namely writing. But let's first start with a bit of your background, and I'm sure this is intertwined, in fact, with writing have become something of your vocation. So if you can just give us some of your personal and professional academic background, whatever you feel is relevant or important to know.
Well, I suppose my adult life started when I went to Cambridge University, where I read social anthropology. A lot of people assume I read English literature, and I didn't. I read social anthropology, which is the study of people in society. And actually, that was an incredibly good basis for the kind of things that I became interested in, because I'm also very interested in psychology, obviously, and that I've caught up on with reading. So starting with social anthropology was absolutely wonderful, and especially in Cambridge, which is a great place to be. And after that, I became a teacher, and being a teacher led me to be even more interested in the way people work together, people learn together, people are involved with each other. I very fairly quickly moved from teaching primary school children to teaching adults. And my move into teaching adults was partly at a university teaching creative writing. So I was teaching things like how to write sonnets and proper short stories and that sort of thing. But I also, perhaps more significantly, taught at one of the English residential colleges. And the residential colleges, Ruskin College in Oxford is the most well known, are places for people who missed out on education first time round. And this particular college is set in an area very near the big coal mines that, of course, were all closed down under Margaret Thatcher. And so there were an enormous number of unemployed people, coal miners, and people who grew up knowing they were going to be coal miners, and their wives, who, of course, supported them. And then the mines were closed, and they needed to think again. And they came and did creative writing with me, believe it or not, at this fabulous place, which is a Baroque and Palladian mansion in wonderful gardens. And these ex-miners sat at really basic tables and chairs and so on in these fabulous rooms with painted ceilings. And those people taught me just so much about how people can work together, learn together, and what writing can do for people. It was amazing what they wrote, and it was amazing what they learned through it. And that really helped me, along with my own personal experience, to realize how much we can allow writing to teach us. If we can give ourselves permission to put on the paper anything, which is very hard for some people, but these miners did. And my own personal experience that allied with this was that I didn't know it at the time, but I was a very mixed up, troubled person, because what my writing led me to understand much later is that I'm an incest survivor. And through an extremely painful writing process, I discovered this. And I couldn't trust a therapist. I read a lot about therapy, and I started to train as a therapist, and then realized it wasn't for me. But all the therapists I tried, either I couldn't trust them, or as far as I was concerned, they weren't trustworthy. I found, for example, they tried to save me. Well, I didn't need saving, but I did find that writing was absolutely incredible, a very trustworthy, paced process. It never took me anywhere where I couldn't go. It was unbelievably painful, but I needed to face the pain. And so my own personal experience was that writing really, really was almost magical in what it could teach me about myself and my past. And what I started learning with all the other people that I worked with, because after working at Northern College, I then started to do research into therapeutic writing. So I started working with people as part of my academic research, people who were dying, children who were dying, and depressed people, to name a few. And all these people that I worked with, as well as my own experience, more and more taught me and confirmed how powerful writing really is. And I don't want to jump the gun in what you're going to be asking me, but one of the things I discovered about writing that I really had to help people to understand, and a strategy to use, is that in order to allow ourselves to write anything on the paper, which, as you probably know from your own experience, and many other people probably know already, is absolutely vital to finding anything out about ourselves. You have to give yourself permission to write anything on the paper. Normally, we have what Ted Hughes, the late English poet laureate, called a policeman on duty in our mind, who doesn't, or a police person, who doesn't allow us to express just what we want to say. And so we have to find some way when that police person is off duty. My own metaphor for that is, when I'm in London, I go to rather a wonderful place, the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden. And the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden, where lucky me, I managed to find cheap ways of getting tickets, has a fabulous gold and crimson auditorium, which is where, as audience, we're allowed to go. We're allowed to go to this beautiful auditorium, and the curtains open and we watch this fantastic performance, and they're always fantastic. But where I'm not allowed to go is up behind the curtain onto the stage, and into what I learnt is acres and acres of spaces behind the stage, because there's rehearsal stages, there's obviously storage, there's offices, there's the places where they store the costumes, and so on. An absolute glory place of treasures behind there, and I'm not allowed to go there. Now, it's exactly the same with our minds. Normally, we don't allow ourselves behind that crimson and gold curtain. We have to live in that lovely, bright auditorium. But, however, there are times when we really do need to go behind that curtain to find things out. And some people find therapists are absolutely wonderful in helping them go behind the curtain. But for those for whom the therapist can't take them behind the curtain, or the areas you can't go behind the curtain, writing can help you dodge the ushers who will immediately say, no, go back there. And to get behind that curtain and to find, to go on adventures and exploring behind there and find things out that we couldn't possibly have imagined. And what I and my students and the patients that I worked with, the dying people, the poorly people, the depressed people, we discovered that not only do you find behind that curtain things that you need to know, you ought to know, things that will change your life, but actually the whole process is an adventure in itself and can be enormously exciting as you discover things, and of course fantastically creative, so you can create stories and poems which are really lovely things in their own right, and you can be proud of along the way, using images which can be, for example, for me, a very powerful healing images was that of angels, which sounds quite funny, but I found the thought of a guardian angel at that stage of my life hugely supportive, and the angel spoke to me and helped me to, through the writing of course, helped me with my life. So I've probably answered that question far more fully than you expected me to, but for me, that early part of my adventure at that residential college and with the patients I started working with, and my own writing, is extremely significant, and you were very right to ask me to talk about that.
Well, thank you so much for that very moving and touching and insightful and very personal account of your history, and as it dovetails or intersects what has become your life's work. So, and I really love that metaphor. I heard you discuss that in another podcast appearance, of the Royal Opera House metaphor of, you know, this moving to the backstage of one's mind as a analog or a metaphor to what you're trying to do with reflective writing. And you're a pioneer in this field, a trailblazer, I don't think that's an exaggeration to say, a major figure, but it's embedded in a larger and older tradition of reflective practice. People like John Dewey could be seen as pioneers, the educational theorist, philosopher. But so if you could maybe discuss what reflective practice is and how reflective writing is so integral to this approach.
Yes, very happily. And my involvement in research into writing for reflective practice, developing that whole area, went hand in hand with my research into therapeutic writing with patients and people who could use writing to help them psychologically. Because I was an educator and because I was really interested in how people learn and how they develop. So I was not only an educator, but also a professional person. So it became of great interest to me how people could develop professionally. And the field of reflective practice is perhaps one of the most vital areas of professional development, because we're within reflective practice, professionals, and they might be any professional. So I've worked with a massive range of or professionals, and a massive range of professionals use my book on reflective writing, or so my publishers tell me. And through reflective practice, a practitioner who might be a doctor, a lawyer, a social worker, prison officer, a police person, a clergy person, so it could be any professional at all, is able to take parts of their professional experience and really deeply reflect on their practice to be able to inquire into issues within their own practice, to tease things out, to find out how they can possibly improve their practice. Because as we all know, we do whatever we do professionally with other people. And it seems that, for example, if to take a very simple example of teaching, that if the child or the adult that I'm teaching doesn't understand what I'm saying, it's very easy to blame the person that you're teaching, the pupil or the student. And for example, it's very easy for a doctor to blame the patient because the patient isn't taking the medicine or the patient isn't doing what they've told them to do. And it's much harder to inquire into one's own practice, actually, to find the real reason why one isn't relating to the patient or the child or the adult student, and really putting over what we're doing with them so that our interaction can be successful. And I realized very early on in my career that the role of writing stories about our own experience, and even when I was teaching creative writing, straight creative writing at an English department in the university, that one of the best ways to encourage people to write well was to write from their own experience. So tell the story of something that happened to you in writing, something significant that happened to you. And I found that through using the power of writing to help people to learn things about themselves, to go behind that curtain where they hadn't been able to go before, actually quite often because it never occurred to them that it might be helpful to go behind that curtain, people could actually really effectively inquire it into their own practice. So if we take an example, a type of example that I worked with rather a lot, which is a doctor working individually with a patient. And to the doctor, initially, it seems quite straightforward. Oh, the patient came with this presenting symptoms, and I said, oh, it's this, that, and the other. And the patient said, oh, then I should do that. And then they went off, but they didn't get better. And why not? Or they completely fell apart, or whatever happened. And as far as a doctor's concerned, they did what they always did. They did it right. Well, if the doctor could be encouraged to write the story of that incident in detail and then reread it and really relate to it, they might be able to pick out what went wrong. And one of the really powerful things I discovered with this kind of reflective writing for professionals was if I asked a professional to tell a story like that, to write a story like that about an occasion in their professional life, and then to write it from the point of view of the patient. So my example is at the moment of a doctor. So it would be from the point of view of the patient. Sometimes it was the point of view of the nurse who was working with them, or somebody else, but quite often with the patient. And we found time and time again that seeing the situation and really seeing it, which of course you can do, as you know, you can do this in creative writing. You can't do it in thinking for some reason, but you can when you're writing a story. Mm. You can get into the mind of the other character. And that is the absolute beauty of creative writing, that in real life, there is no way I know what you're thinking. No way I can know what anyone else is thinking. We can't, and we know this is a given. Whereas if we're writing about a character, we can know what the other person's thinking. And so these professionals would be writing, it wouldn't be a true account, they don't know what the patient was thinking, but they were imaginatively putting themselves in the place of the patient in this situation, or the student, or whatever their profession was, and perceiving the whole situation from the point of view of the other person. And this was one of the strategies that proved incredibly powerful, just about every time powerful for people to explore what happened. We did use all sorts of other strategies, like, for example, changing the gender of the other person. Well, what if this person had been a man? How to tell the story with the other person as a man, and then the professional is able to say, oh, if I look at the two accounts, I'm actually relating differently to the man than I was to the woman patient or student or whatever they were. And that sort of thing can be a tremendous eye-opener to the practitioner, who would say, of course I'm impartial. Of course I just relate to people as people. Shall I give you an example of a powerful occasion of...
Yes, please.
Of writing, of a doctor writing as if they're from, as if they are the other person. And this was a doctor who, I never actually met him. I just read this account in the British Medical Journal. And he said, oh, I read this book about reflective writing, my book. He said this in his article in the British Medical Journal. And so I thought I'd give it a try. And I was stuck with working with a particular family because their child, parents' child, had nearly died of meningitis. And they were furiously angry with me because I hadn't diagnosed it. Well, meningitis is extremely difficult to diagnose in its early stages, he wrote. I tried to explain this to the parents, but it was no good. And they were absolutely furiously angry with me that their child nearly died. And so I was furiously angry with them, and our relationship completely broke down and was absolutely no good. And so I decided to write from the point of view of the parents of the child. And I only had to write two sentences. I didn't have to write any more than that. I didn't have to write the full story. I think he did write the full story, but he said he didn't have to, because as soon as he wrote, he really put himself into the position of those parents, those frightened parents. And he said, I suddenly realised they were terrified. They were really, really frightened. And it wasn't just anger. It wasn't just anger with me. The anger all came from their fear, their absolute terror, how nearly they lost their daughter. And so I invited them back to come and see me. And all my anger had gone with them. And so I was able to relate to them and really help them on their road to understanding the situation. And that was all from writing just two sentences from the point of view of the patient. And there are probably, possibly thousands of examples like that, which I don't know about because they haven't written about them in a journal. I might come across. But I do know from the people that I did work with that the writing in that kind of way really helps them to get out of only seeing things from their own perspective, because practice, professional practice, is perspectival, and we don't realise that when we're in it. We think the situation just is. Well, it isn't. The situation is how I, as practitioner, perceive it, and other people might perceive it totally differently. And the job of the reflective practitioner, educator, is to try and help people perceive this.
Well, I think perspective taking, sorry, yeah, perspective taking is so vital.
Yes, it is.
And so that's really a key term. Sorry, I interrupted you unintentionally.
What I was going to add was that another thing that reflective writing can really be helpful to help people explore are their values. That values are once more something that we take as given. As professionals, we go into our practice, we practice with people or with situations, whatever that is. And our values are like a kind of bedrock. Well, reflective writing can really help you to tease out what your values are. And when, as a practitioner, you have values in practice, which are in theory, I mean, which are in your head. Of course, I'm anti-racist. Of course, I'm not sexist and all these things. But actually, if you can properly reflect upon your practice through writing stories about it, you can, to your horror, perceive, as I said earlier, about... oh gosh, I related to that person differently when I thought they were a woman than when I wrote about them as if they were a man. That is a bias in me that isn't consonant with my values and something I need to think about. So yes, perspective, the perspectival nature of our experience and our practice, but also being able to examine our values in practice, which we so rarely do.
Absolutely. Very vital, both at the individual and societal level, which I'd like to explore a bit later. But in a chapter, when you introduce reflective practice and with it really reflective writing, you write about the difference, but of course also the interrelation between reflective and reflexivity, which I found quite fascinating because I think intuitively one sees those words as coterminous or really synonymous, but you delve into that in a very, I thought, illuminating fashion. So maybe if you can discuss this important distinction.
Yes, thank you for asking this, because I think it is a common perception that reflection and reflexivity are the same. And it's something that students or professionals who are having to do reflective practice as part of their ongoing training, they struggle with understanding the difference between reflection and reflexivity. And I'm very glad you think that I explained it clearly, because I certainly worked at it. Reflection is when we reflect on our own experience. And it's like looking in a mirror or in water. And we're really seriously trying to get behind that initial flat image in the mirror and see what's going on behind. Reflexivity is when we're looking at our own role in this and how we relate to the situation. So to give a simple example of reflexivity, if I was working with a group of people, we could spend the whole session together reflecting on their experience as practitioners. And then at the end of the session, I might say to them, now, I think we should have a period of reflexivity now. We've been doing reflection all through this session. Now let's do some reflexivity. And the reflexivity is actually examining how I am relating to the other people in this group and really trying to understand in what way I am influencing what's going on in the group and how we are influencing each other. So reflexivity is, in a way, reflexivity means like looking in double mirrors. So you're seeing it reflect back at yourself. It's a way of looking at yourself intensively and the way you and others are reacting to a situation. And I give the example of a group because it's fairly clear to see how different that is. So when we're doing the reflective practice, we're looking out there. This is my work situation. This is the way I reflected on it. What's your views on this? And they will all give their views and they'll have a fantastic discussion. And then the period of reflexivity is saying, now, what are we doing here? What are we actually doing in this room together, and how are we influencing each other now? And somebody might be able to say, oh, well, now I think about it, I think you're rather a bully to somebody else because the tutor has given them permission to do this kind of thing. And that's the kind of thing we're going to try and tease out. They might not be quite as rude as saying, I think you're rather a bully, but they might say words to that effect. And then the group will be enabled to examine the roles that they've taken on within that group. So the person who's been told they're a bit of a bully might realize, well, actually, in this situation, I'm not usually like this, but I have rather pushed rather hard at what I think here. And I'm not listening awfully well. Perhaps next time, and it's upsetting the others and they're not communicating so well. So perhaps next time I'll really work at trying to listen harder rather than push my own views over towards everybody else. And so a period of reflexivity, whether it's you and one other person or whether it's you and the page, can really bring you face to face with those kinds of things about yourself and how you relate to other people and your impact on other people.
So reflexivity is almost reflecting upon reflection. It has a metacognitive component. You're thinking about thinking. Yeah, that seems quite complicated to do for many people, or at least initially. I mean, reflection can be difficult enough, but I do really appreciate that distinction because they're both very, very vital for the overarching goal of cultivating greater reflectiveness and, of course, reflexivity. Now, you've just mentioned it in your explanation, but another concept or term that you tease out, through the mirror writing, which I really liked that as well. I enjoyed reading about it. So as I said, you've touched on it. Maybe you've kind of explained it in a way or at least strongly hinted at it. Maybe you can elaborate upon that a bit for us.
Yes, very happily. It's really nice you brought that up because this draws on an image from, I think, one of the finest books in the English language, or rather pair of books, and that is Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland and Alice Through the Looking Glass. And listeners might think, but they're children's books, whatever she's thinking about them for. But in fact, Lewis Carroll was an extremely clever academic, and these books are unbelievably clever. They really, I think, if you read Alice in Wonderland and Alice Through the Looking Glass carefully, you will find that they probably look at a huge number of psychological issues that as human beings we tussle with. And in Alice Through the Looking Glass, Alice climbs up to the huge Victorian mirror, we call it a mirror now, in those days they called it a looking glass, that hangs above the fire. And she finds she can go right through it. And what is on the other side of this enormous Victorian mirror? Of course, everything is back to front in the world behind the mirror. And this exploration of everything being back to front, which Lewis Carroll spends the whole of the book exploring, all kinds of different ways in which things can be back to front, about is an extraordinary psychological exploration. And it's the kind of exploration we don't normally allow ourselves. And that's why it's such a powerful image for reflective practice, that if we can allow ourselves, it's very similar, of course, to going behind the opera house curtain. If we can allow ourselves through into this dangerously different world where everything is back to front, then we really can be able to look at things with some kind of a critical edge. And this word critical is really significant in this context, because we don't normally examine anything in our lives with any degree of critique. And in order to undertake effective reflective practice, we do have to be critical. We do have to bring a process of critique to bear upon it. And Alice, when she goes through the mirror, she is the most remarkable girl. She's very, very strong and very strong in her sense of self. And she goes through this weird world, as she does in Alice in Wonderland, asking questions. And as Rilke said, it's not the answers to questions that are nearly as significant as the ability to ask questions. And I'm a parent and a grandparent, and children will ask why. They'll ask why. And why is the really significant question. What, where, who, when, how? Well, they're sort of factual questions. You get factual answers to them. But if you ask why, which is what Alice asked when she went through the mirror, but why? That's when you really discover exciting things. And that's what we're doing in entering the almost kind of back-to-front world of reflective practice. It seems like a back-to-front world, because if I put myself in the place of my student, or a doctor puts themselves in the place of their patient and writes from their point of view, well, that's not what we normally do. That's a kind of back-to-front thing to do, isn't it? But really, we're asking why. We're saying, why did this patient respond like? Why did this patient ask this question? Why was this patient anxious about this? Why, well, the story I told you, why were they so furious? And as I've said, you can quite quickly come to some kind of an understanding of those questions, why. And that kind of understanding might lead you to ask more questions. Well, that's great. But that understanding can actually be life and career changing.
It's one of certainly the most crucial questions anyone can ask of themselves, the world around them, but also probably among the most terrifying for both individuals and, again, society at large. So, yes, so much contained in a three-letter interrogative salvo right there. But let's return to, I suppose, something, you know, a little bit more basic. If someone wanted to introduce this into their lives, so maybe they haven't read your books, although they should, or they don't have access to a wonderful facilitator such as Dr. Julie Bolton. And you've mentioned that writing for as little as 6 minutes a day is really all it will take to, in a way, jumpstart or to begin this process of reflective writing. That just seems a very short time. First of all, I suppose, how could they go about doing it, and why for only 6 minutes?
Well, frequently people think of reflective writing, or therapeutic writing for that matter, and they think, oh, I haven't got time to do that. Oh, I couldn't possibly fit that into my daily life. I'm such a busy professional. I'm such a busy mum, or whatever they are. I couldn't possibly do that. You need ages to write. You need time to think about it and then to do it. And that, of course, is just putting it off. That's a kind of self-protective strategy for not starting. And it's part of Ted Hughes's policeman, who's preventing people from looking at things in this way. Whereas if you really can allow yourself to put a pen on a page, and I recommend using a pen or a pencil or a pen on a page rather than the screen. I'll explain why later. If you really can allow yourself to do that and allow your hand to write whatever comes, then you don't need much time to get into it. You've gone through the curtain, you've gone through the mirror, and things have become different. And so the really significant thing for someone to do is to get into that position where they can put their hand on the page and allow themselves to write anything. And my suggestion is that if you can say to yourself, I'm only going to do this for 6 minutes, well, anyone can give 6 minutes, that's nothing. I can manage that in between doing this and doing that. And if you can persuade yourself to do that, that's the first thing, to give the 6 minutes. The second thing is, can I persuade myself that this 6 minutes writing is totally, utterly, and completely private. No one else is going to read it. And as soon as I finish it, if I want to, I can tear it up, burn it, get rid of it in some way so that really nobody can read it. That's the second thing. There is a third one, of course. These things, as you know, from fairy stories and magic things, everything comes in threes. The third thing is, I must allow myself to forget all the rules of writing I was ever taught. Rules of writing in this kind of thing, that is about punctuation, spelling, proper order of things like not splitting infinitives and all that kind of really boring rule. None of that matters. We can make words up if we want to. We can spell them however we like. We can put the words in whatever order we want. And in fact, I've found that dyslexic people are particularly good at this kind of writing. And when they come in and say, I can't do this, I'm dyslexic, I say, oh, good. Well, that's absolutely brilliant. Because dyslexic people are actually usually very creative. If you can persuade them, put that pen or pencil on the page and do it. And so if you can sit down with a pen or pencil on a piece of paper and just start putting on the page whatever's in your mind and following those three things, three guides that I've just said, then in 6 minutes, you will have found some area that really interests you, that really fascinates you, and you will have found that words pour out of your pen or pencil onto the page. And very few people want to stop after the 6 minutes. They then carry on. And so I recommend that when you've come to the end of your 6 minutes, and you might have set a timer, that you then allow yourself to carry on, but follow a theme that's come up in the 6 minutes. Or you might feel, I haven't quite got to the theme that really interests me. I've been putting it off. But this is really what I want to write about. And off they go, and they'll start writing about what they want to write. But still using those three guides that I mentioned. And those three guides are very significant in anything that you write in this kind of way. And I arrived at the 6 minutes rather than 5 or 10, because somehow 5 minutes just isn't long enough. We think of, oh, 5 minutes, that's nothing. Mm. We think a 5 minute chunk of time is an insignificant chunk of time and just not quite long enough. Whereas 10 minutes, somebody would think, I can't give 10 minutes to doing this. That's a bit of time I can't. Whereas 6 minutes is only a tiny bit more than 5 minutes, which is nothing. And interestingly, a lot of people have said to me over the years, you were so right about the 6 minutes, that 6 minutes was just enough to get me into it and to tell me that I could carry on. And if, as you say, it's somebody who can really only give 6 minutes in the day, if they really wrote for 6 minutes every day, even with just that, things would start to happen.
Yeah, I think that's wonderfully practical advice and doesn't seem in any way onerous to even very busy people to fit that into their schedule or schedule. The next question, I mean, on one hand, asking a question such as, can anyone benefit from reflective writing? I mean, at first blush, it seems quite self-evident that of course, but I'm sure you've encountered over the years someone who might say something along the lines of, or imagine a type of person, they live in a developed country, they're comfortable materially, they have a loving wife and children, and they're doing well professionally, and from the outside, and even to themselves, their lives seems more than satisfactory. They really have no glaring problems or issues that they're dealing with. Now, admittedly, they will probably have to ignore something like climate change and perhaps other geopolitical upheavals. But in their personal situation, they're doing remarkably well. Someone like that could probably say, well, Dr. Bolton, why would I need to engage in this practice? There's no trauma in my life. My life is great in every way. What would you say to this imaginary person?
Well, of course, that person isn't imaginary. I've come across, as you could probably guess,
yes.
A couple of medics and, interestingly, police come to my mind. Yeah. People who are, and I think about them as being sort of shiny, having like a shiny surface. There's nothing for me to grip onto superficially. They're shiny, and they feel shiny to themselves. You know, I'm all right. I'm all nice and buffed up and shiny. And actually, they're probably the people who really do need to examine themselves, because that kind of shininess is a defence, isn't it? It's a pretty powerful defence. And you're quite right to use it as an example, because how do you get beyond such a powerful defence? And those people would only come to reflective writing if they had to. So if, for example, they had to do a professional development course to keep them within their profession, that had to include some reflective reflective writing. And I have found people who have come along to such sessions very defended and very actually quite cross with me. They'll start off quite cross. Oh, I don't need to do this. This is stupid. This is silly. This is a waste of time, of course, is what they say. And sometimes, for the lucky ones, it takes them by surprise and grabs them. For the unlucky ones, and as you've guessed, of course, there have been people, professionals that I've tried to work with, but interestingly, extremely few people who have been entirely proof against it, that kind of solid, self-defensive shininess has proved to be proof against it. And then, of course, there will be the professionals who have managed to evade this kind of professional development altogether. You know, I need to go and learn about X. You know, I need to go and learn about this subject. I need to understand this subject more. I don't want to. What's the point of looking at my own practice? I tell my patients what to do, and they either do it or they're either stupid and don't do it. And there's nothing I can do about them. As professional educators, we do have to recognise that there are people out there that there's no way we can reach them, however hard we try. They're too shiny. Everything reflects off them.
That's a lovely image there, and I think it captures it so perfectly. Now, I suppose this next question, again, I detected some hints in your answer, and I'll probably be accused of trafficking in political correctness or identity politics, but are men more resistant in your experience to reflective writing than women, or is it more about the station in life or the shininess, as you might say?
Yes, no, it's. I would say it's not gender, because when I was young, I always used to think of men as being the inheritors of the world, that they're brought up to think that they're inheritors of the world, whereas women, we're not. You have to struggle to become that. So you might think it would be men who would be greater proof against it. But actually, because men are the inheritors of the world, they in a way, they have to struggle less to maintain their shininess, whereas the women who've done really well in life, they do sometimes have to struggle really hard to maintain their shininess. I mean, if you think of our total worst example in England, Margaret Thatcher, rest her soul, nothing would ever have got beyond her shininess, will it? I mean, I remember seeing her in the House of Lords, and this even that helmet of hair, you could, and the makeup, you could see she was, and the way her clothes, she was the Iron Lady, and it was a very shiny iron. It was definitely buffed up stainless steel, and there's no way anyone would have got beyond that. She's just the most worst example. But no, not gender. I would say not gender, and I would definitely say not race, not colour. No, I do think that the kind of way I had the huge blessing to be able to work with people and the people who use my methods through my books, I do think it reaches the humanity of people and goes beyond gender and colour and those other things that we might think of as being the kind of obvious barriers. It's the psychological makeup of the person that might give the shininess or might make them accessible. And actually, there are some people who are so keen to explore themselves and do this kind of thing and think that they're really open to this sort of thing. In fact, they might have just as much difficulty as the very shiny person, because in their sort of superficial eagerness, they're covering up and underneath self-protection. So it is the complexity of human nature we're dealing with here, rather than those superficial differences. Yes, I would say, from all those many years of experience that I had, it's an interesting question.
Fascinating. Now, I've been a journaler since 2004, and I regret not taking it up when I was even younger. And I did go through a phase when I was living in Korea, when I was busier, I wasn't journaling as much or more when I went on trips. And I've rediscovered a daily journaling habit about 4 years ago when I was in France. And it's really something that I value deeply. I mean, it's something I feel I have to do every day. It's in the evenings before I read, before going to bed. And I'm surprised at how few people, not that I have a huge social circle, do this kind of thing. And I feel that, you know, so much of our lives are fragmentary. We, let's say, travel, have different jobs, so many pressures upon us. And this has given a kind of a continuity, an overarching narrative to my life. It's something physically you're anchored, because I handwrite. So there are these journals. I've traveled quite extensively, lived in other countries, that I can say, okay, this is a journal for this time and
place. And I just find it so valuable to me, you know, spending this hour or so a day, but describing it in this way of manifesting a sort of a more of a continuous selfhood and this anchoring in the world in a physical and emotional, intellectual sense might sound to many people so abstract, so kind of vague. Is there, and again, I'm an advocate of the journal and journaling. Does this sound to you like so much blather, or is this something that has validity, do you think? Is it a way to argue for journaling?
I think your experience echoes mine, really, because ever since I started writing a journal, as I told you, was many years ago, 40 years ago, something like that.
Wow.
I think I could almost say that it's a kind of second life. That I lead my normal life as a wife, a mother, grandmother, mother-in-law, a sister, aunt. And then there's my own private life, which, as I said before, it does have to be private. And absolutely nobody reads my journal, nobody at all. My husband knows. We've been married for 50 years now, and he knows that I write it, and he knows it's amazingly significant, but he would never ask to read it, though we do sometimes talk about some of the things that I write about. And I think I call it a second life because it's a very real kind of adventure, exploration, isn't it? And that kind of psychological adventure or exploration is endlessly significant and alive, very, very, very dynamic. And you might think, well, surely that's destabilizing. Surely that makes you psychologically unstable to explore different aspects of your character. Because I do things like I think that inside me, I have as though there's a team, and I work with my team to do things. And so sometimes when I sit down and with my journal, I'll say to my journal, my hand will write it. Okay, team, where do we go from here? I'm stuck on this one. I don't know what to do about this, whatever it is. And I do this all the time. And this is, again, allowing your hand to write what it's going to write without this interfering part of you preventing you from writing it. And I'll watch my hand write, well, Jilly, and it'll then go into stuff I could never have thought, none of these things would ever have occurred to me. So it really is going behind the mirror into looking glass land or behind that curtain. And exploring things about myself. And it's helped me to make decisions or to understand things. For example, being a mother-in-law is classically one of the most difficult things in life, isn't it? But to grasp things that otherwise I might just think, oh, I'm upset about this, or I'm really furious with her, to try and work out what's going on here. And my team is made up of, well, probably across the spectrum of characters. So inside me, I've got a very strong man. A wonderfully strong man who advises me about certain things, I was brought up very much as a girl in the early 50s in kinds of ways I would never have thought of. I've also got a little boy inside me who is endlessly useful. He gives me endlessly useful advice. He's not very good with words. I get very few from him, but the few I do get from him are very valuable. And there's a little girl, of course, and there's a mummy and so on. And there's the kind of really organized kind of woman I'm not, you know, with hair that always stays in position and a crisp white blouse who has the kind of organizing mind I don't have. And I listen to what they have to tell me. I really do. And they speak to me in all kinds of what you might consider to be very strange images, just as Alice, through the looking glass, comes across all these strange characters and situations and just thinks it's completely mad. But actually, if you look under the surface, what Lewis Carroll is exploring is something that's very far from mad. They're things that we really do need to consider. And it is as though in writing a journal, you allow yourself to have this second life. And people who say, oh, I haven't got time to do that, possibly do that. What a waste of time. Oh, gosh, my life is so full. I couldn't possibly do that. Well, we can always say that. I would say I don't have time to watch television. And I don't. We watch films sometimes, but we never watch television. We'll choose a film and we'll watch it sometimes. And I suppose there are all sorts of other things that I don't have time to do. I don't wander around shops, window shopping. That for me would be an enormous waste of time. And so I suppose I do carve time in ways that suit me in my life, the things that I don't do. Anyone can do that because we are in charge of our lives. We are the authors of our lives. And if you can pick up a pen or pencil and start to write your life, you really are becoming the author of your life. And I think a lot of people, it doesn't occur to them, they are the authors of their lives. We do have authority over our own lives. And if we're going to be good parents, good professionals, good friends, and so on, good spouses, we need to grab hold of that authority. We need to know that we are authors of our lives. And as you say, writing the journal really can, that process of writing, being the author of what I'm writing, that I'm writing my inner life, all those strange secret things that go on in there, and I'm rereading them. It really does help.
Beautifully put, yes, the author of our lives, because we are writing the story of our lives in one way or another. So why not do it in a more literal sense? Now, listening to your descriptions of your own journaling practice, I feel, and this is what I wanted to ask you, not to belabor too much on a personal matter, but I feel I should perhaps hone my journaling practice, because I see it predominantly as the French saying aide de mémoire. So there's the two levels. It literally can help assist your memory a few years or months down the line. You can look at a journal entry, oh, I did that, for example. But it also exercises your memory. Memory is a muscle to think back, in my case, a few days ago, then writing. And that's very important, I think, as cognitive exercise. But I feel then that I'm more recounting what happened during a day. It's more event-based. There's inevitably some reflection, some thoughts. I have opinions about various matters. But it seems as if with your own practice, if you don't mind me asking, it seems a lot more personal, a lot more about probing thoughts and ideas and issues you're dealing with. Am I right in saying that?
Absolutely, yes. I do write practical things. So I write all sorts of practical things, or practical problems that I'm tussling with. You know, I don't know what to do here. Do I do this or do that? Well, actually, you don't do either. You do something else altogether. But I do spend quite a lot of time using images to open up areas of my psychological experience that I wouldn't otherwise be able to explore. And it is said of metaphor, particularly, that metaphor is the doorway, the way through to unlocking memories, experiences, thoughts and feelings where you couldn't otherwise get to them. Mm. Because psychologists protect us. They protect us. So if, for example, someone like me, I'm an incest survivor, well, the stuff there no one would want to remember. And the stuff there I have never remembered, and I never will retrieve those memories, and I don't want to. I know quite enough, thank you, without rediscovering that those actual horrible memories. I don't need to. And so our minds really, really do protect us very seriously. And how do you get at the bits that you really do need to get at for your psychological health, your psychological development? And actually, it's through metaphor. So where do we get metaphors from that will help us? Dreams, actually. Freud called dreams the royal road. Well, they really are, actually, and you don't need to know the whole story of a dream. What you do need is a single image. So, for example, for me, I dreamt that I was in a really horrible corridor, and I don't know if you know, but corridors are a fantastic metaphor for being stuck in life. You're stuck in a corridor. And I was in one of those horrible corridors like they have in English schools. And there was a door out of the corridor. And when I opened it, there was a lot of light coming out of it, but it was coming from down below. And since I was on the ground floor, that meant it was down into a cellar. And that was all that the dream was. And in my writing, I thought, I've got to get down into that area down there. And so I wrote and wrote imaginatively getting down into that cellar area. And I found the ladder and I went into the cellar room. And that exploration, taking that very simple, small image from my dream, that metaphor of being stuck in a corridor and then finding a way down into the depth of myself, really. And what I found down there was something that was really significant in my understanding of myself. And similarly, once it was all I retrieved from the dream was a pair of red shoes. That was all. And I don't know if you know the fairy story about the girl who wanted red dancing shoes. Mm. And they glued themselves to her feet and she couldn't take them off and couldn't stop dancing. In the end, she had to have her feet cut off to stop her from dancing herself to death. And through an extraordinary process of writing, which I won't go into because it would take too long. That was one of the things that opened up to me about my abuse, that I was forever dancing, that my father had given me these shoes and I was forever dancing away. And I had to have my feet cut off, really, in order to free myself of my father. If you can find a significant image in a dream or a significant image in life, something that you either suddenly hear or you smell, so it could be the smell of vanilla. Say you write down the smell of vanilla in your journal. That's really felt electric to you. Oh, write down vanilla. Allow your hand to write from that and see where you get to. And these metaphors, like my metaphor of the cellar, can really open things up. Very significant metaphors are.
It's great advice, I think, for both myself, but I think for anyone listening, about the opening up into the inner corridors of ourselves, of our minds, through these techniques. So thank you. That's, yeah, definitely, I think I will.
I just like to underline my other technique of thinking that we have a team of characters in us, which I originally got from Gestalt psychological theory. And that can be a real opener. So if you can write for I'm a woman, so writing to the strong man inside me, or even to the little boy inside me, I would just say to your listeners, just try it. Write to that child and ask them to write back. Ask them to write you a letter and tell you anything. Just say, I often write in my journal, what have you got to say to me? And it's always an opener. Try it.
Thanks, because I think there's one thing to talk about or discuss the theory of, let's say, reflective writing, reflective practice, but to have these practical tips, I think, are totally invaluable. And what's the worst that could happen? You learn more about yourself and you've engaged in a creative exercise. So it can never, ever be wasted and almost always enriching. But yes. No, I was just going to maybe move on now to, although they're intertwined, if you don't mind spending a little bit more time discussing therapeutic writing. So reflective writing could be seen as maybe the umbrella, and then therapeutic writing is a more specific kind. So is there a ready-made or relatively straightforward definition of therapeutic writing?
I suppose so. I think therapeutic writing is when anyone, it certainly doesn't have to be somebody who considers themselves a writer, definitely doesn't have to be somebody who considers themselves a writer, can allow themselves to write, to allow their hand to write without the interference of their mind. That sounds incredibly simple, and I suppose it is incredibly simple. And in order to do that, the person who's doing the writing has to want to be engaged into some kind of exploration into what I call this other world, this other life, this other part of themselves. That process, even for somebody who doesn't consider they need therapy, as most of us don't, will inevitably be therapeutic. It will be psychologically supportive.
All right. Now, in one of your books, Write Yourself, I'm going to read just a portion thereof, because in the first chapter, you write that writing can help achieve increased communication, self-understanding, and well-being, alleviate stress and anxiety, dramatically support positive self-image, and can have significant therapeutic effects, end quote. And then a few pages later, you write that, quote, therapeutic writing can help people understand themselves better and deal with depression, distress, anxiety, addiction, fear of disease, treatment and life changes, and losses such as illness, job loss, marital breakdown, and bereavement, end quote. So that's quite a lengthy list of potential conditions that can be addressed or treated through therapeutic writing. Now, someone of a skeptical bent, that's in fact the title of my podcast here, or even someone more cynical, they're certainly not the same terms, would say, how can something so simple affect so many dramatic changes or ameliorate so many often severe conditions, Dr. Judy Bolton?
Well, that list, of course, comes from my experience, or all the people who I have worked with or come across or I know have been significantly helped with writing through those issues. And you say, how can something as simple as therapeutic writing or creative writing, we would call it. How can it help in such a dramatic way? I would answer, it's because it's simple.
Mm.
It's because it's simple. It's something anybody can do. It doesn't require special equipment. It doesn't require cleverness. In fact, I always say to people, cleverness is one thing I want you to switch off, because cleverness is quite part of our policeman or opera house usher system, preventing us from really looking at things properly. So it doesn't require special equipment. It doesn't require cleverness. It requires us to be human. It really requires us to be human. And it really requires us to be willing to face something about our humanity, which is something perhaps we often run away from. And in order to be able to do that, it has to be simple, really. It has to be a really, really simple process. And drawing with a pencil can be, if it's facilitated and advised by somebody who knows something about drawing, which I don't, but I do know that art therapy is hugely significant, as is music therapy and movement therapy. But the arts, in their very simplest form, do have this tremendous power to enable us to grasp something about our own humanity. And it's that very simplicity. It's as though it's stripping away our layers of covering over, because we cover, as people in society, we cover ourselves over with piles of things. Oh, I'm an efficient mother. I'm an excellent nurse, doctor, teacher, whatever it is. I'm a wonderful wife, and all these things that we think we are in the real world. Whereas if we can allow ourselves to strip ourselves down to, this is just me as a human being with a pretty basic piece of equipment in my hand, a pencil and a piece of paper, which is very hard for some people to do, to strip themselves down to that level, then you can begin to get through that mirror into the world, the other side. So it is the very simplicity of the process. All you're doing, it is a cultural thing. I know writing, it's not like speaking, which is just physical. But if you can allow yourself just to do that, that's where the doorway is, in something simple.
I was interviewing Stephen Batchelor last week, who's written about secular Buddhism, and we were discussing mindfulness meditation, and he used this term as well, simple. He said, but it's simple, but not easy. Those, of course, are not the same thing. And of course, this definitely applies here to reflective or therapeutic writing can be very difficult, but richly rewarding. Now, in the sections of your book I just quoted from, you do cite a number of studies. So I'm just curious, because another area of interest, what I'm trying to promote with this podcast, is the scientific method or rigorous analysis. Now, with something like therapeutic writing, reflective writing, it must be quite difficult to actually do large-scale studies. If you've had many personal successes or in the groups you've worked with over many decades now, so are there studies, and as I said, they're quite difficult to do because you'd need to have a control group, and then, you know, there's issues of a sample size and how lengthy are the studies, so they have to be longitudinal, does that last months, years, to potentially see the effects, the long-standing effects, and maybe even involving brain scans, although, you know, just because a brain has changed might not tell you all that much, because your brain changes if you learn to juggle for 3 months. So are there studies in this fashion, or is it more qualitative studies that have mostly been done? So what's your insight into this?
There are quantitative studies, yes, indeed, that have been done into writing. It is, as you say, a really tricky area, because if you ask people to do a certain amount of writing, and it has to be absolutely set if it's a sort of proper quantitative study, and then you do certain physical tests on them afterwards to see how this or that or the other, their immune system, say, has improved. As you say, you never really know what's caused that improvement anyway. It could have been something else in their life. This is always a problem with quantitative studies anyway. Mm. And so although some of this research has been really successful and seemed to prove that, writing can really work with these people, I do think that it's qualitative studies that really do show that the results. Our culture has got a bit stuck on thinking that quantitative studies, because they're numbers. Mm. Our culture's got a bit obsessed with numbers, particularly recently during this corona the virus business, where I don't know what it's like where you are, but here we're bombarded with numbers all the time, and they're always presented meaninglessly. Actually, you can't ever make any sense of them. They're just numbers. And that if you've got a figure that you can put on something, then that proves it. And I would say that as a qualitative researcher, which of course I was, those numbers don't really teach us an awful lot. That the qualitative studies where you've actually taken the trouble and the time, and it does take time to find out about people's experience, that that's the way of really understanding what's significant. And I do think that it's science has gone off on a bit of a wrong tack, or popular understanding of science, perhaps, in thinking that if it hasn't got figures attached to it, then it's not significant. Mm. So yes, there have been studies, and they have been extremely successful. I don't know if there have been any very recent ones. I'm not up to date on it because I've retired. But it's a very difficult area to research the quantitative methods, yes.
Often the challenge. But then, so would you say that creativity, you mentioned art therapy, has an inherently therapeutic quality to it?
We always feel better when we make something. Mm. And that's a wonderfully simple rule. And it's wonderfully true that if you can make anything, even if it's a good meal, you're going to feel better. You're going to feel better about yourself, going to feel better about the situation. And if you add on to that, not only that you always feel better when you make something, which you do, but also that if that actual making process is itself personally informational, let's say, it tells you more about yourself, then you've got a double process going on. The creative process itself makes you feel better, and you've used the power of creativity to help you understand yourself better. You might say, and there have been studies along these lines, well, that can't be true, because actually, if you look at the lives of, say, poets, they were all pretty bonkers, weren't they? Well, they were. They were pretty bonkers. But I don't think it was the poetry that made them bonkers. Mm. I think it was the other way around. I think people who are willing to be psychologically open to themselves, and for those of us who need to, like I did, because of my childhood abuse, or because you've got some other psychological problem. And I've got a friend's daughter who's bipolar, and she's also an artist and a musician. And I know she's using her art and music to help her explore herself, because she needs to. Mm. It's not the art and the music that's made her bonkers. So although you might say, well, goodness me, look at all these poets and painters, they were cut off their ears or killed themselves or whatever they did. Well, we are looking at the extreme examples there. So yes, you do have a double thing, that art makes us feel better, but also, or creating anything makes us feel better, but also art does have the power to enable to explore those areas. You've got that double thing going on.
Is there ever a danger in therapeutic writing of perhaps triggering maybe either not necessarily more trauma, but reliving? I've actually, a friend of mine experienced some traumatic events over a few years, and I actually advised that this could be a method, but they're also receiving other psychological counseling. And I think writing is part of this. And they explained to me that they felt a bit as if they then relive this particularly bad experience. So have you noted this in your own experience dealing with people?
I'm really glad you asked that, because I think it's a really important area. And writing in itself actually will never take people to areas where they don't want to go. So, for example, at that college I mentioned, one of our residential colleges, people who had missed out on education first time round, one of the men wrote about his experience of being one of the very first going into a concentration camp after the war, which from the tiny bit he wrote was unbelievably traumatic, as you can imagine. I very gently encouraged him to write some more, but he was absolutely clear he was not going to write any more about that. And that was absolutely right for him. He'd brought it to the surface. He'd shared the fact with the group that he'd been one of the first to go into a concentration camp after the war to liberate it. But to go into any of the details would have been very damaging for him, and he didn't. And I suspect he still hasn't, like my father-in-law, has never really explored his awful experiences in Burma during the war, and people didn't. And my own experience of my own trauma is that it took me years to get at what was wrong with me, and it took me absolutely years, and not gentle, I won't call it gentle, but paced, I would call it paced probing of my writing to help me understand what had happened and to help me to come to terms with it and help me to begin to heal. But I do think that it's very important, if you're going to start doing therapeutic writing, that you do it with some advice, like from one of my books or from somebody. It doesn't have to be a therapist that you're working with, and it doesn't have to be a person, because there's loads of ideas in my books. Because, for example, if somebody thinks that it'll be therapeutic just to keep rewriting the incident of what they remember, what happened to them, that won't be helpful, that they're much better off coming at it from all the myriad of kinds of different angles that I recommend in my books, because actually they're exciting and fascinating. The other thing that can be damaging, which people have told me, not damaging, I mean, it can lead people to give up writing therapeutically, because they just say, oh, it just made me feel more depressed. It was awful. Because these people think that all therapeutic writing is writing down all the stuff they're depressed about. Mm-hmm. Oh, I feel really awful today because all this awful black splurge onto the page, and not allowing themselves to explore anything positive. And so they give it up because it just makes them feel worse. And quite right, it has made them feel worse. It made me feel worse too. The thing to do are the kinds of explorations that I've been sort of hinting at. And my books are just packed with different ideas, which are adventures in themselves, really, but they're also psychological openers. Mm. So you might be the kind of person who can just pick up a pencil and start writing and explore it. Or if you say to yourself, I've just got to explore this really depressing stuff, and I'll only write when I'm depressed. Some people say that to me, I'll only write when I'm depressed, and then I write all my depression. I think, oh dear, that's not a very good way to come at it. Whereas if you take my advice about the 6 minutes, that you write for 6 minutes, and then the thing that really interests you and involves you, that's what you want to explore. Not just staying with all those black things, whatever the black things are.
Now, you've written many books on the subject, and of course, a famous one, I think it's now in a sixth edition, Reflective Writing. If someone wanted to become a facilitator or try to offer workshops or work with people individually, other than perhaps reading your books, what kind of advice would you give to someone who wanted to move into this space, as we say in modern parlance?
I would definitely say, as you suggest, that reading my books will certainly help you get there, because the book that you mentioned, the one that's just about to go into sixth edition, is, I think it's sixth edition. Yes, there are sections in it which advise a facilitator how to do it, as there are in the therapeutic writing books, actually, just the same. And that kind of advice really is needed, because the facilitator has to be extremely open and non-directive in a way, I think, because rather like I said about the bloke who was one of the first to liberate concentration camp in Poland, it probably was. I didn't push him. The last thing I would have done was push him to carry on writing about it. And an insensitive tutor might say, oh, well, you've got to carry on exploring this. This is an area that you need to explore. And that would have been very damaging. The other thing that I would really significantly, which is just as important as reading my books and learning about the process and reading other books about reflective practice and writing, I would say you have to practice it yourself. In order to be an effective facilitator of either therapeutic writing or reflective writing, you do have to practice it yourself. And I think it's always been really significant in my work that I have never asked anyone to do anything I haven't done myself. I put that in the negative, but everything I have asked other people to do, I've always practiced it myself first. And I have a regular practice myself of writing a journal and of writing poetry and stories and all sorts of things, journalism and whatever it is. So what I recommend other people to do, and the way I advise them, is rooted in my own practice. And if a practitioner isn't doing something that's rooted in their own practice, they shouldn't be doing it. And if they stop loving doing it in their own practice, if they stop being incredibly excitedly involved in it, that's when they should stop doing it. And I once thought I used to do Tai Chi, and then I thought and then I stopped because our teacher left, and I found another Tai Chi teacher, and I had one session with her, and I asked about her about her individual practice. And she said, oh, no, I don't have a practice, I just teach. So I didn't go back to her, because it's not a significant practice in her own life. So how can she teach me to have it as a significant practice in my own life? That really is true with this area.
But then but you have some background in education, but also therapy. So would, let's say, studying psychology and therapy and counseling, would that have to be part, would you say, of, you know, offering, let's say, reflective writing services, if I can put it a little bit crassly?
Yes, you're absolutely right that I think you don't need to do more than read around. And obviously in my time as an academic, I've done massive amount of reading around in associated psychology and sometimes sociology and education principles and practices, methodology. So a grounding in all those kinds of things would be incredibly valuable. And for example, if I hadn't read about Gestalt theories, or if I hadn't read extensively about Freud and so on, there's all sorts of things I wouldn't have understood. And similarly with group practices, with thinking about working with a group, it's hugely informed my practice that I've read a lot of theory, and I've read a lot about other people's experiences, of course. So yes, the more you can widen your understanding of the field, if you really do want to get into this kind of field, the better.
Well, thank you for that. Now, you know, there's so many more questions I could ask you, but we've been going for just over an hour and a half already. You've been so generous with your time. I don't want to impinge upon it anymore unnecessarily. But maybe in closing, reflection and indeed critical thinking, which is something I'm very passionate about. I try and cultivate that in my students, or certainly have over the years, and reflective practice and reflective writing, certainly part of that. But we as a species seem depressingly and maddeningly unreflective, and we're facing a myriad of challenges where we will only find any kind of solution through deepening our reflection and certainly calling into question the status quo. I know that you discussed that in your book on reflective practice, which I found very valuable. You know, everything really is up for grab, must be examined. Socrates is alleged to have said the unexamined life is not worth living. So how, and I know this is really a very big question, so answer it any way you see fit, but how can we endeavor as individuals to promote more reflective thinking and writing and practice, both within ourselves and our community and the larger world?
I think as much as anything, it's being kind to ourselves. I think we've rather learnt not to be kind to ourselves. We've rather learnt that we need to be strong and tough out there in the world and tackle it and actually fight, really, a kind of pugilistic attitude to life. I'm a Quaker, a member of the Society of Friends, so clearly my whole attitude to life, because I've been a Quaker since I was 20, so that's 50 years, my attitude to life will always be pacifistic. But also it does seem to me to be really significant to be kind to ourselves and to pay attention. Really, that is incredibly significant advice. Pay attention, because that's being kind to other people, paying attention. So much in our lives, we're so concerned to get out there with our views, our ideas, and push things to happen, make things happen. And we're not human doings, we're actually human beings. And we don't spend enough of our time being. We think we have to go out there and keep doing all the time. And being kind to ourselves is allowing ourselves to be human beings and to pay attention to the world. And I know it's a bit of a cliche at the moment that being out in nature makes us feel better. You get it everywhere, don't you? As if we didn't already know that if you go for a walk by the sea or in a wood or do some gardening, you feel better afterwards. And if you go out and just be with a friend, you feel better afterwards. Well, going outside and being outside and listening to the birds, or walking in the hills as I do here. I live in an incredibly beautiful place. And also being with friends and really listening to them properly, we are actually paying attention. And if we could bring that ability to pay attention, to listen, really to listen and to see, to perceive what's going on around us. If you think of all that I said about reflection and reflexivity, actually, and therapeutic writing, it's all paying attention. It's all listening, perceiving and being open to asking those kind of questions. Because if we really are listening, perceiving and paying attention the whole time, we're asking why. And when you ask the question why, you're opening yourself up, aren't you? You're opening yourself up to something, learning something from out there in the world. And that can feel dangerous if you're not very brave person. You've just got to be braver. You've got to be braver to be kind. You've got to be braver to pay attention and to ask why.
I really love that. Human. Sorry.
Carry on.
No, I love that we're human beings, not human doings. That's an observation, or a connection that isn't often made. And I love also the synchronicity or the consonance with mindfulness meditation of this paying attention, being in the moment, because writing can also be a flow state, which seems the opposite. But yes, there's also reflection is a paying attention. So that was wise words, indeed, as virtually everything you've said has just positively reeked or dripped with wisdom, Dr. Julie Bolton. But we've mentioned some of the books, but just the last thing I'd ask you about, where can people find out more about you, obtain your books, etc.?
Well, I'm very easy to find on the web, because all you need to do is put my name in, because my web address is www.jillybolton.com. It couldn't be much simpler. And there you'll find information about all my books and various things actually that I've talked about my life and my research and the kind of things that can inform us and help us to pay attention and really listen and to ask those questions why. So www.jillybolton.com, and you'll find out about all my books and then start reading them, hopefully.
Yes, and also there's some delightful poetry, including one particularly memorable poem, or I found it as such, about writing, the power of writing. I thought that was really great. But thank you so much, Dr. Julie Bolton. This has been an extraordinary conversation. I've enjoyed it immensely. It's been so illuminating, so I think powerful, just extraordinary on so many levels. I think that there's so much to digest, to contemplate, but also hopefully to apply to all our lives. So I can't thank you enough for giving so very generously of your time.
Well, you've been absolutely marvelous interviewer. Thank you so much. It's you who's encouraged me to say it all.
Well, thank you so much, Julie. Have a delightful rest of your day and weekend. Thank you so much. Keep spreading your wisdom, your light to a world that's so desperately needs it.
Same to you. You're actually getting it out there with your podcast. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Julie. Take care. All the best.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye, Ron.
Thank you. Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving a rating and a review wherever you listen to your podcasts, especially on Apple Podcasts. I would also really appreciate it if you could help spread the word among your friends and family. In fact, feel free to tell perfect strangers about Skeptically Curious, because the more people that know about the podcast, the merrier. If you're feeling particularly generous, please consider leaving a donation via the podcast's Patreon page. That's Patreon, patreon.com/skepticallycurious, one word. The intro music is titled Fortitude, and that's by Lance Conrad. Until next time, thank you and goodbye.